People were surprised that Sunday morning you won't find anybody on the street. They're all watching Mahabharata on television. So people, they became very much interested by this. But at the same time, due to modern education or whatever, people, they tend to doubt, how can the Mahabharata be actually real? Because in the Mahabharata, as in any scriptures of the world, there are many incidents related which appear to be fantastic or unbelievable. Just like we read in the Mahabharata of so many things. Arjuna, he went through outer space and traveled to Indraloka. The Panch Pandavas, they are born from different gods, right? From Surya, of course he gave birth to Karna, then Yama to Yudhishthira, and Indra to Arjuna, Vayu to Bhima, Ashwini Kumaras to Nakul Sahadev. So this seems, what is this? It doesn't seem possible. And Karna was born from the ear of Kunti, therefore his name is Karna. And in the battle we see that mantras were applied to the arrows. So they would shoot an arrow and say a mantra and different things would happen. The arrows would split up into 50 arrows. Or the arrows, they would, by the power of the mantra, from the sky, rocks would come, or fire would come, or snakes would come. So many different things. And many times in Mahabharata we find voices from the sky. Or we find people who are die and brought back to life again. So many things which seem fantastic and unbelievable. And in other scriptures of the world also, just like we'll find that in the Bible also, people dying brought back to life again. The most famous example is Jesus Christ, who died and 3 days later came back to life. And in the Bible we find so many things, just like when Moses was taking the Jewish people out of Egypt, they had to cross the sea. So by the power of God, the whole sea just opened up and they walked through. And there's so many things. So can we believe these things or not? And mostly, of course, people say, no, we can't believe it. Why should we believe it? We never saw or heard of such things. We can't believe these things. We tend to think that in the past, people believed this kind of thing, but nowadays we are more advanced in education and we don't believe these things. Actually, what happened in medieval Europe, beginning from the 17th century, the philosophy of rationalism was developed. Now, of course, previously people in Europe, as in any other part of the world, they tended to believe in God, to believe in the Bible or the Quran or the Vedas, whatever scripture they were following. But the rationalists, there were so many, Voltaire, Hume, Western rationalists, different philosophers in different parts of the Western countries. They, more or less, they brought up the philosophy that if I see it, I believe it. And if I don't see it, I don't believe it. And that was extended to the other senses, which means that if I can see, hear, touch, taste, smell, or feel, then I can believe something is true. Otherwise, I don't believe it. That's why many times people say to us, prove that God exists, as if they expect us to bring a test tube and a Bunsen burner and some litmus paper and a few chemicals and react them and God will appear. They think that everything should be verified scientifically. Unless we can see something, unless we can prove it, we don't believe it. Now this philosophy is practically the most widespread philosophy in the world, and I think many of you are probably science students. Any science or any discipline you're following, whether it's history or geography or whatever, the whole idea is that whatever knowledge we have, that should be verifiable. Is it not? If we can verify it, then we believe it. And if we can't verify it, then we don't believe it. Just like we can verify whether a liquid, we have a bottle of whether it's acid or base or neutral, by applying some litmus paper. So then you can verify this is acid, this is base, or this is neutral. And you can test the pH value. So like this, it's something which you can verify very easily. Now, something which we can't verify, we tend to disbelieve. Just like if I told you that my mother was born on the moon, you probably wouldn't believe me. Would any of you believe me? I think probably not. And you would ask me to prove it, and I would have to produce a birth certificate from the moon or something like this. So it's not very believable. What we can, something which is within our range of experience, or something which we can verify, we believe. There is the experimental method in science by which we, the experimental method in which we examine a group of facts, and based on that we make some speculation, some hypothesis. This way theories come. Then we put the theory to the test, experiment. And if we can prove it, then it becomes a law. That's why we have different theories in science, and we have laws. There are laws of thermodynamics, and there are some things which have not been proven, just like theory, relativity theories, the unified field theory. There are some things which are not proven, but which we tend to accept anyway, even though they're not proven. But the actual scientific method is that we should prove it. Now, in this idea, rationalism, empiricism, everything we can only believe if we can prove it. Now, there is an inbuilt fault, or at least two or three inbuilt faults in this theory. Later we'll come back to Mahabharata. Let's look. Now we're dealing with epistemology, which is the, epistemology means the science of how we find out what we believe, what is the basis of our belief. So, this idea, I can only what we see, feel, hear, touch, taste, smell, and feel, that we can believe. There is inbuilt faults in that. Now, one of the faults is that our ability to perceive through the senses is very limited. Just like we can only perceive light within a very limited spectrum, is it not? We can't see ultraviolet, infrared. If it goes too much one way or the other, we can't see. And similarly with hearing, if it's too high pitched or too low pitched, we can't hear it. And similarly with all the senses, it is very limited. Now with machines, we can measure light and sound, which is even beyond our immediate ability to perceive. And with machines, we have picked up all different kinds of energies which are floating in the universe, and we can measure them, just like electricity. We can't measure, we can't see electricity. Electricity is everywhere, but we can't see it, we can't perceive it. But by scientific methods, we can harness that electric energy, we can measure it, and we can utilize it. Similarly, there are many radio waves, they're everywhere, but we can't immediately see it. We can't in any circumstance see it, even with any machine. But we can catch those radio waves by using radio apparatus, and we can relay messages. So similarly, many different kinds of energy are floating within the universe, and scientists have tapped some of them. Even 200 years ago, or even 100 years ago, if we told people about some of the things that we are doing now, they wouldn't believe it. Just like if you told people 100 years ago that all over the world, people, they will watch television. There's Olympic Games is going on in Barcelona, and we are sitting in Baroda, and if we are so inclined, personally I'm not, but if we're so inclined, we can watch live broadcast. means you can watch and it comes from thousands of miles and only just a split second after the action takes place, practically you're seeing it on the spot, on the second, what's happening. So it is something fantastic. If we told people 100 years ago, they wouldn't believe it. Even when I was born, if we were told that everyone would have a computer in their house, and on your computer you can do so many things, then we wouldn't believe it. Now there are many other kinds of energies also, just like there is thought energy that has been, scientists, psychologists, they have made inquiries and experiments, and they have discovered that people with strong willpower, they can influence people to do things. Just like there were experiments done even over 100 years ago of people who, different people would stand outside someone's room, and that person inside, they wouldn't know. Or even they could be 1 mile away or 10 miles away, and they would just concentrate. Now you leave your house and go and visit your friend. And they found, they did this kind of experiment, that just even from a distance, just by concentrating, trying to influence someone's willpower, that person unexpectedly, even though they may not have visited that friend for 2 months, they would get up and go. So like this, many experiments have been made. Of course, experiments in the field of psychology, it is more difficult to verify. The more subtle the science, the more difficult it becomes to verify. In chemistry, it is easier to verify than in physics, because physics is a more subtle science. Chemistry, we're dealing with chemicals. Physics, we're dealing with waves, energy. So naturally it becomes more difficult to verify. Now in the field of thought, it may be very difficult to verify, because it's a more subtle kind of energy. Now my point is that there may be many, many different kinds of energy which we are not aware of. And if we simply say that we only believe what we can see, hear, feel, tell, smell, taste and touch, then we are limiting ourselves, because there may be many, many kinds of shakti within the universe which we are not aware of. Even some scientists in the 1950s, they postulated first the idea of antimatter. 2 Russian scientists got a Nobel Prize for giving the theory of antimatter, that there may be a different kind of matter which is existing simultaneously with this matter. There may be another whole universe going on in another dimension side by side with us, but we have no ability to perceive it because we are locked in to this kind of matter. And there may be another kind of matter which is completely independent of this matter. And there may be people walking through us and all kinds of things going on. There may be multi-dimensions. We are existing in 3 dimensions, but there may be multi-dimensions which we are not aware of. So the first effect of the rationalistic empiric theory is that it does not take into account that there may be many levels of reality, there may be many levels of perception which we are simply unable to perceive because we have limited senses. If we say, I only believe what I can see, I only believe what I can hear, then we are limiting ourselves to these senses. But the senses which we have are very imperfect. Just like, for instance, I'm speaking with a microphone, because if I don't, I have a very weak voice, maybe due to speaking like this for so many years. So, my ability to speak is limited, and people's ability to hear is limited. I cannot hear. There must be so many conversations going on this campus right now. There must be several hundred conversations going on, but I cannot hear it. My ability to hear is limited. It is limited by time and space, and it's also limited by that innate inhibition. Just like, you know, they have a dog whistle. If you blow the whistle, the dog can hear it. I cannot, because it's a very high pitch. So our senses are very limited. Therefore, if we limit what we believe to what we can see and hear and feel and what we can perceive through our senses, then immediately we are assuming that there are no other levels of reality beyond that which is available to our senses, which is immediately a foolish assumption. We can say it outright, that the whole of modern so-called philosophy, wisdom, science, education is going on the very foolish assumption that man has the ability to perceive everything. But why should we accept that? On what basis? On what basis should we accept that? Now we can give an example. Consider the position of the ant. Now there may be many ants crawling here. Now the ant is existing in this room, and I am existing in this room. But for the ant, what is the ant's perception of reality? The ant's perception of reality is, here is my hole, here all the ants live. I come out, I find a grain of sugar, I bring it back. And that is his whole reality. For the ant is living in this room, but he has no ability to perceive what is going on. He has no idea what we are doing here. He has no idea that this building is built by human beings. He has no idea what a human being is. The ant has no... If we discuss what is economics, sociology, religion, politics, science, technology, mathematics, the ant is completely unable to perceive these things. These things are reality, but it is totally beyond the ant's ability to perceive, because the ant has that only this much ability to perceive. Even if the ant is crawling on our body, the ant doesn't know that this is a human being. All it knows is something I'm crawling on. And if we go like this, it can think there is some danger. But it has no developed intelligence. So similarly, it is not unrealistic for us to hypothesize that we are existing in this universe or on this earth planet, and there may be many living beings who are far more superior to us and who can perceive reality in a far more broader spectrum than we can. If there's one genius ant, let us suppose that among the ants there is to the ants what is the equivalent of Dr. Einstein. Now, just like Dr. Einstein, if he tries to explain to us what Albert Einstein perceives the universe, his perception is so developed that even though he can write it in mathematical formulae, it's very difficult for an ordinary person, practically unless you're a genius, you can't even understand what he's talking about. His intelligence has been so much more developed than ours. So similarly, if Dr. Einstein the ant tries to speak to the other ants that actually there are human beings and what we're living in is a university and there are many people living here from Gujarat and there are different parts of India, and the ants, they can't understand what is this Gujarat, what is India, what is a university. It's completely beyond their power to even think about. So we have seen Dr. Einstein, but there's no reason to suppose that even above Dr. Einstein, there may be many living beings whose ability to perceive reality is far more developed than us. And they may well be looking down at us as if we are ants. So that is the first thing, that why do we doubt so many things? We doubt the existence of God, we doubt the scripture is true, Mahabharata is true, we think it's some kind of mythology, some fairy story. We doubt mostly because we are brought up, the modern education system brings us up only to accept as reality that which is within the range of our limited sense perception. But actually, if we consider in a cool-headed and logical way, then we should consider that it is very likely that there are many levels of perception which are far above ours. After all, we are only living on one tiny little planet, in one tiny little galaxy, in a huge universe. So why should we think that we have all the answers? And why should we think, why should we dismiss as untrue something simply because it is not within our power to understand it? There is one very interesting story told about Dr. Frog. Dr. Frog was a great philosopher in the frog community. He was considered the most intelligent frog of his time. He used to sit at the bottom of his well and give learned discourses on frog philosophy. Now, he lived in a well. The well was 20 feet deep and 20 feet wide. And Dr. Frog sat at the bottom in the Frog University and gave very learned discourses. So one day, one young frog jumped out of the well and he went on a tour by Indian Railways. And he came to the ocean and he saw the Arabian Sea, huge Indian Ocean, huge ocean. And Dr. Frog, he got on a ship and he sailed across the ocean and came back. And after many years, he came back to his home well in Baroda. And he jumped down his well. And there he saw Dr. Frog, very old, very famous, the greatest frog in the history of the frog community. The greatest philosopher, the greatest scientist, Dr. Frog, double PhD, Nobel Prize winner, MSc, MA, Dr. Frog. So, Dr. Frog welcomed back the traveling frog, and he gave him his blessing, and told him, and he asked him, "What have you seen?" It's just like someone goes on a space voyage. "What have you seen?" He said, "Well, actually, I saw the ocean." "What is the ocean?" "The ocean is a..." The point here is that we may not be able to experimentally prove, almost certainly we won't be able to experimentally prove, still we should not reject what is described in Shastra as fairy stories. The question may come, then how do you differentiate between a fairy story and what is described in Mahabharata, Ramayana, the Puranas? Now the difference is that in the Mahabharata, Ramayana, Puranas, even in the Bible, so many things are taught. But they are not taught as fairy stories, but they are accepted by great acharyas. This is another point. That those who are expert in spiritual science, which is a transcendental science, they accept the words of Shastra. Just like previously in Indian culture, if somebody said something to somebody, "You should do this," then the other person might say, "Why should I follow you? Is it a Vedic injunction that I should follow you? Is it Shastra Vidhi?" In other words, Shastra Vidhi was accepted as unrejectable. Whatever is said in the Shastra must be accepted. That is the rule. Now we may say that is dogmatic, that is blind faith. But actually it's a fact, even from the material platform, if we follow Shastra, we will find that it is completely correct. Just like in the Shastra, it is said that stool is so impure that if you touch stool, you have to immediately take a bath. Now, of course, these are Vedic rules of hygiene, very good rules. If you follow, you won't get sick. But it's also said that the cow stool, the gobor, the stool of a cow, is pure. And so pure that you use it to clean your house. You can use it for the deities. When you do Abhishek of Krishna, you mix up the cow dung, the cow urine. So how is it? It seems to be contradictory. But actually, if you scientifically analyze, you will find that cow dung is full of all antiseptic elements, which is why people put all over their house every day. Even now in Bengal, Orissa, in the villages, They mix up water and cow dung every day and smear it all over the floor. And if you put it there, it will be completely antiseptic and no flies will come. A similar example, it is said that the bone of an animal is impure, but the shank we use for puja. So it seems contradictory. But the fact is that, of course, that is not understandable by scientific analysis, but the shank is so pure that that is acceptable even to God. So even if we analyze from a material point of view, we will find everything in the Vedas is perfect. Just like there are so many sciences. Astronomy, there is Vedic astronomy. Now you can study astronomy by Western system. Gradually they have discovered many planets. And by studying the different planets, you can say when Mars will next be visible, what is the orbit of Pluto, all these things they can say. But these things are also in the Vedic astronomy many thousands of years ago, when they didn't have radio telescopes. But the knowledge is there in Shastra, Surya Siddhanta, Srimad Bhagavatam, and Vishnu Purana, different Shastras they describe. And there are Vedic astronomical tables which give the exact movements of the planets. Otherwise, everyone knows astrology is a very developed science in the Vedic culture. That is, astrology is based on astronomy. That knowledge was there even before we had the Western system of astronomy. So how is it possible that we may or may not know? Actually, we know. We accept that the Vedic knowledge is given at the creation by God. Just like if you purchase a microphone, you get a booklet which describes how to use this microphone. Is it not? So similarly, with the creation, God gives books how to live in this world, how to utilize it. Those books are Shastra. There are different divisions of Shastra. And they're all very useful for human society. There is Ayurveda. Ayurveda, that is medical science. It is a highly developed science. It is modern medical science. It only depends on the chemical, biochemical reactions within the body. If there's something wrong in the body, give an injection, give some pills, or give surgery. But the Ayurvedic science is much more subtle because it examines that disease is not caused simply by the chemical malady has a deeper cause, which means that the life airs, there are life airs within the body which are not balanced. There are 10 different kinds of life airs. There are three main substances, kapha, pitta, vayu. And when these are disordered, then disease occurs. So in Ayurveda, they treat not the chemical imbalance, but the imbalance of life airs, which are so subtle that even today in modern medical science, they can't find it out. So much science is there. The science of music, everybody knows that the Vedic science of music is highly developed. The science of rag, tal, so many things are there. Highly developed. Even the instruments which are used traditionally in India, like sitar, there's no such complex instrument in the whole of the Western world. But still, despite so much knowledge and culture, we reject. We say, I don't see it, therefore I don't believe it. This is like the ostrich philosophy. The ostrich, you know, when he sees an animal coming to kill him, he can't run away. He puts his head in the sand and says, I can't see anymore anyone coming to kill me, therefore I'm safe. This is foolishness. This is owl philosophy. The owl, he flies around at the night, and in the day he closes his eyes. And if anybody asks the owl, just look at the sun, the owl will say, no, my eyes are closed. I don't see the sun. I won't see the sun. So if we say that we don't believe in anything we can't see. That is owl philosophy, ostrich philosophy, frog philosophy. It is not the philosophy of a very developed human being. Even the great scientists of the world, like Newton, Einstein, they could not have developed the knowledge which they have gifted to human society if they had not been willing to think beyond the limits of reality as it was taught to them. Is that not a fact? Einstein revolutionized science by daring to think that there could be concepts of science which were completely beyond the scope of that which was being taught at the present time. And he dared to think beyond the limits which were imposed on him. So we should do that also. We shouldn't think that only what I can see on television, that is reality. There are so many things which we may not be able to understand. And actually the Mahabharata itself gives a very good formula. Achincha kalu ye bhava natang takena yojiyat prakritebhyo parangyat chat tad achintyasya lakshana. It says, the Mahabharata says, there are many things which are achintya. Achintya means it may not be within the power of our brain to immediately understand. Mahabharata says there are many things which are achintya. But Mahabharata says such things, they should not be the discussion of argument, because it is not within our power to argue about them at all. That which is presented by higher authorities, we should simply accept. Just like if we go into the physics class or the mathematics class, let's say mathematics, we go into the mathematics class and we are taught something, some formula. When you first see calculus, it looks so difficult, you can't imagine what is going on, is it not? When you first see calculus, all you're used to is maybe some simple multiplication, some simple algebra, and all of a sudden, here you are, calculus, and there's this all these funny signs, and you don't know what's going on at all. And the teacher shows you how from the original calculus formula, you expand it and develop it, and it looks fantastic, and you can't understand it at all. And then you get into more advanced calculus, and when you first see it, it looks just so difficult, you can't understand. But then you simply accept that the teacher, he knows. So many people, they know, and the teacher, he knows, and even though I can't understand it, let me accept at least theoretically that it is a fact. If I walk out of the mathematics class and say, this is too difficult, I can't understand it, it's all rubbish, I'm leaving, then we are the loser. The calculus is a fact. But if I walk out because I can't understand it, and therefore I say calculus is all rubbish, if calculus is not rubbish, I'm rubbish, because I don't have the ability to understand it. But if we patiently hear from the teacher, from the professor, then we can gradually understand. By training, we can gradually understand, and we will also find that we can sit down with a calculus and we won't be afraid. We can just do, very simple, there's the answer, right? In the beginning it looks impossible, but after being trained, we can understand, oh yeah, straightforward. This is a straightforward calculus operation, and we do it. We sit down and we write it out. So in the same way, there are many things which may appear to be fantastic, impossible to understand. But that doesn't mean that we should reject it. If we reject the wisdom of Mahabharata, just, I don't believe it, finished, then we are the loser. Because there may be many things which are difficult for us to understand in Mahabharata. But alongside with that, we should at least recognize there is so much good knowledge of how to live in this world, how to be a good person, how to develop our life for the future life. There is spiritual knowledge, how to understand what happens after we leave this body, how to get free from repeated birth and death. In Mahabharata, the jewel of the Mahabharata is Bhagavad Gita, This is a great science. Bhagavad Gita is the jewel of the Mahabharata. It is the essence of all spiritual knowledge condensed into only 700 verses. Such valuable knowledge that people all over the world are studying. People all over the world are getting enlightenment from Bhagavad Gita. But if we reject that, I can't understand it, I can't believe it, therefore I reject it, then Mahabharata will exist. That knowledge will continue to exist. But we will be the loser. So how to get the knowledge? That is described exactly in Bhagavad Gita itself. Tadvidhi pranipatena pariprashnena sevaya upadekshyanti te jnanam jnaninas tattva darshana. To understand his knowledge is something like going to your mathematics teacher. You go to the teacher and he teaches you and you inquire from him, and in the beginning it may seem very difficult, but by gradually being taught, you can develop and you can understand it. A brilliant student, he can pick up just like that. You'll find some people, they're 8 years old, they're a brilliant mathematician, is it not? Some people 8 years old, little children, and they're fantastic mathematicians. Mozart, at the age of 7, he did his first compositions. He sat down at the age of 4 at a piano and started playing. Brilliant, genius from birth. So of course, different people have different abilities. Some people develop more slowly. But the system is there. You go to a teacher who can teach you. That way you can also understand. Just like, what is the science of God? That is a great subject matter. Great persons throughout history have applied themselves to this subject matter. In the Eastern world and in the Western world and on other planets also. We should not think that great persons like Jesus Christ, Buddha, Ramanujacharya, Vallabhacharya, these, if we see throughout history, who have been the most influential persons and who are the people who have contributed religious life, moral life, ethical life, persons like Francis of Assisi, Jesus, these names like Ramanujacharya, Madhvacharya, they were all great people. They were all highly intelligent people. They were all powerful people. They were all renounced people. They weren't interested in getting money, exploiting others, getting political power. They were simply interested in giving something good to others by giving knowledge of God. Actually, people like Madhvacharya, Buddha, Jesus, they were all very powerful. They influenced the minds of many people. They had many disciples who were willing to do whatever they said, but they never utilized it for personal gain. They were all living as sannyasis. They weren't interested. If they wanted, just like Madhvacharya had so many followers, if he wanted, he could have taken over India. If he told everyone, now you take up a sword and follow me. He could have become the emperor, but he wasn't interested. People, they would give money to, just like Raman, but before Ramanujacharya, there was one Alva, Alabandhu Alva. So much money was given to him. But he himself lived very simply and built big temples. So these people are great people. They have shaped civilization. The teachings of these people, they are the most influential in all of modern society. Even the greatest thinkers of modern time, like Karl Marx, his philosophy has come and gone. And we see even great scientists, what they teach, it comes and then again their theory is changed. Actually, the greatest scientists in history, like Newton and Einstein, they all believed in God, as a matter of fact. They may not have known exactly who God was. Just like Einstein said, at the end of his life, he said, now, after all my studies, my only question is, I want to know how God made the creation. So, our point is that we should not reject out of hand that which is not easily understandable. But we should rather open our minds to that which is apparently fantastic and see what many, many great people in the past have accepted And we can also accept. After all, God has made this creation with innumerable planets, with so many fantastic things. It is a fantastic thing even that the planets are floating in space. That in itself is fantastic. It is fantastic that the oceans, there is so much water, but the oceans, they don't come and flood. The ocean goes for thousands of miles, but it stops at the beach at Bombay. And why? It just stops exactly there. Huh? There are so many fantastic things. Volcanoes are fantastic. Giraffes are fantastic. The human body is fantastic. The human body is so fantastic, not even the human body, any body. It's so fantastic that even though big scientists have been studying for hundreds of years with billions of dollars of research materials, they cannot understand what is going on in the body perfectly. They cannot even cure the common cold. Even neuroscientists say that even after so many years of study, we only have a very limited idea of what is going on in the brain. So the whole creation is fantastic. There are so many things. Why can we not at least theoretically accept that all the things described in Mahabharata Ramayana are, at least theoretically, we should be open-minded enough to think, at least it may be true. We should not just reject. If we reject thinking that I can't believe in it, that just proves our own ignorance and small-mindedness. Then we are like Dr. Frog. I didn't see it, I don't believe it. So our tendency is to think that the whole universe is changing, so many different theories are changing, but the great religious acharyas, those who are perfect models of spiritual and moral conduct, who are perfect models of religious philosophy, who have dealt very deeply in these things, they do not reject. Even in the modern age, great personalities like Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, Bhaktivedanta Swami Maharaj, even in our own ISKCON, there are many people throughout the world, PhD scientists, in Russia especially, many very intelligent, highly educated people are joining this movement because they are thinking that the modern scientific thought, it is very limited. Whereas that which is presented in the Vedic Shastra, it gives us knowledge of the unlimited which we can never approach through science, geography, technology, mathematics. We cannot approach through our own brain power because our own brain power is limited. Whereas the Vedic Shastras describe that which is achintya, that which is